Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the ICN-UCWG webinar. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. If you should require operator assistance during the call, please press star then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded, and I would now like to turn the conference over to Simon Roberts. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and welcome, everybody, to the Unilateral Conduct Working Group web seminar on price-cost tests. We've got a very illustrious and experienced panel who are going to deal with the issues today. We're going to start off with David Gilo, who's Director General of the Israeli Antitrust Authority, then move on to Jorge Padilla from Compass Lexicon. After that, we'll have some time for questions and discussion, and then we'll move on to Martin Mandorf, Acting Deputy Chief Economist from the Swedish Competition Authority, who will take us through one of their cases and how they've applied price-cost tests to retroactive rebates. And then we'll finish off with a view from the US, Joe Englund, partner at White & Case, who's going to talk about some of the important cases that have been in the US and have questions after that as well. This is a very important initiative, I think, of the Unilateral Conduct Working Group in that we're trying to take on the issues that have been dealt with by the Unilateral Conduct Working Group in a practical way, getting practitioners to take us through some of the tests that need to be applied. And so I think this is hopefully a great initiative that's going to make the principles more alive. Before we kick off and I hand over to David, there's a PowerPoint posted on the ICN website on the Unilateral Conduct Working Group homepage. For those of you who may find it easier to download slides from there. And it'll be recorded and also available after the web seminar is finished as well. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over to David, who's going to take us through the appropriate role of price-cost tests in predation cases. Over to you, David.
Thank you very much. And hello, everyone. Let me start with a basic policy question. What is the rationale for the prohibition of predatory pricing by dominant firms? So a dominant firm would like to entrench or expand its dominance, and at times it would like to do so by charging extremely low prices in order to drive out rivals, even when these rivals are more efficient than the dominant firm. But the question is, given this policy question, why do we examine whether price was below cost rather than whether profits were sacrificed, even with above-cost pricing that is, in fact, in a typical situation or a particular situation, predatory? And indeed, predation could occur with above-cost pricing, particularly when the dominant firm is more efficient than its rivals. It could charge a price above its own marginal cost and below the marginal cost of rivals and then drive them out. Nevertheless, if the dominant firm charges prices below its own costs, then antitrust authorities perceive that it's more likely that this dominant firm wishes to drive out rivals, even though it's sacrificing profits in the short run and even losing in the short run, in order to better exploit consumers in the long run after it has less rivals in the market. To be sure, as the next speakers will show, with retroactive rebates, at times the dominant firm doesn't necessarily bear short-run losses and nevertheless is able to exclude rivals, and you'll see that later on. Now, what is the most appropriate measure of cost then in order to apply the predatory pricing prohibition? Before we try to analyze the most appropriate measure of cost, let me scan the main types of cost measures that we have. We can turn to the next slide. So first of all, we have marginal costs. Marginal costs are the costs of the marginal unit supplied. So if, for example, We have a widget factory. Its marginal cost would be the cost it bears in supplying the marginal widget. Second, we have variable costs. Variable costs are the portion of a firm's cost that depends on the level of its activity, given its capacity. So, for example, if we have a widget factory, given its factory and its capacity, the variable costs are the costs of its raw materials, customs, usually its energy costs and transportation costs, everything that changes with the level of activity given the factory's capacity. The marginal costs are actually derived from these variable costs. And now let's turn to the fixed costs. Fixed costs are the portion of a firm's costs that don't depend on the level of its activity, given its capacity. So, for example, the costs of headquarters, rent, machinery, and advertising are usually fixed costs. Finally, I want to mention avoidable costs. These are costs that could have been avoided in the relevant period. For example, if a firm invests in the expansion of its capacity, This typically is a fixed cost, but at the point where it needs to decide whether to invest, this cost is avoidable. My colleagues will touch upon the question whether such an investment in expansion of capacity, for example, can be considered predatory. In the other presentations, you will also see more detailed cost measures that may combine between some of these basic concepts that I've just mentioned. Now let's turn to the policy issues regarding what the appropriate cost measure should be. What's the rationale for the fact that most antitrust agencies prefer a marginal variable cost rather than fixed costs? The reason, in a nutshell, is that with perfect competition in the short run, price typically goes down to marginal cost. So pricing below this marginal cost is a strong indication of predatory behavior because the dominant firm is actually sacrificing short-run profits to reap, and the premise is that this is to reap benefits in the long run from excluding rivals. A firm's variable cost per unit could be an average approximation of these marginal costs. The question is, are fixed costs ever an appropriate measure for predation? And what the analysis above implies is that fixed costs usually should not be an appropriate measure for predatory pricing because as long as the dominant firm is charging above its own marginal costs, it is making a short-term profit. And the premise usually is that in the long run, the dominant firm will be able to recoup its fixed costs using this pricing method. If we condemn prices as predatory merely because they are below average fixed costs of the firm and above the marginal costs, then we might be condemning a pro-competitive behavior that is not necessarily predatory. Nevertheless, in certain cases, particularly when the fixed costs are high and marginal costs are low, as it happens in many high-tech markets, prices above marginal costs but that do not reasonably cover fixed costs, for example, accompanied by evidence of an intent to exclude, may nevertheless, in certain circumstances, be considered predatory pricing in some jurisdictions. Now, how should a court cope with ancillary benefits to below-cost prices? At times, the price in itself is below the marginal cost, but the fact that it increases demand enables the dominant firm to reap short-term benefits that make this behavior profitable in the short run. For example, access to a website, it may be free and below marginal cost so as to enhance traffic, and then the dominant firm would make revenues from advertising. Such behavior generally would not be considered predatory. Now, how should a court cope with predatory investments in capacity? This will be discussed later in the webinar. The issue is that investment in capacity is generally a fixed cost, but at times it is avoidable and has an exclusionary effect. Therefore, causing us to determine whether the behavior is predatory or not. Now let me turn to some implementation issues. First, should below-cost pricing by a dominant firm be considered illegal per se or subject to a rule of reason analysis? The thing is that a firm that engages in below-cost pricing, even below marginal cost, at times, this does not really exclude rivals, particularly when these rivals are more efficient than the dominant firm. This implies that a rule of reason analysis examining whether predation indeed has a high enough probability of excluding rivals, such a rule of reason examination is needed. Second, ideally, who should determine the appropriate measure of cost, the legislator or the court? In the jurisdictions that I am familiar with, it is courts who determine what the appropriate measure of cost is. The upside of this is that it grants flexibility in applying the rule. The downside is that the dominant firms remain uncertain about the standard, and this could at times chill pro-competitive behavior. What are the pros and cons of a financial statements approach to determination of costs? In a firm's financial statements, the cost of goods sold is a rough approximation of variable costs. So in essence, one could take this number from the financial statements of the firm and divide it by the number of units sold in the period covered by the financial statements. This would be a rough average or a rough figure of variable costs or average variable costs. This figure is inaccurate, however, first because the firm it could include in its cost of goods sold in the financial statements portions of fixed costs, making it a biased measure of cost, biased upwards. Second, the statements may be subject to some degree of manipulation, although this possibility is limited by the norms that apply to accounting rules. Now to the case of multi-product firms. At times, a firm produces several products, and nevertheless, its financial statements include only one number aggregating between these products. And here, too, we will face a problem with using a financial statement approach to measuring costs when the predatory behavior alleged is with regard only to one of the products. Also, if the firm makes short-term profits from ancillary benefits, like the case with free web access and revenues from advertising that I mentioned before, a financial statement approach would not work. Okay, so that's it for now. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, David. That was a great introduction. We're going to go straight on to Jorge Padilla, who's going to take us through some of the ways of looking at it and breaking down some of the costs in more detail and talking about the measures that are commonly used in cases. Over to you, Jorge.
Thank you, Simon. My presentation focuses on the analysis of price abuses in the European Union. I'm going to talk in particular about implementation, the design and implementation of price cost tests in EC competition law. The way that I want to structure this presentation is as follows. First, I would like to talk, and this would be in slide number 10, about some of the principles or the most important principles that underline the analysis of price costs, of price abuses, and easy load. And then what I will do is I will spend a few minutes on each of the principal categories of abuse, of pricing abuse, predation, margin squeeze, bundle rebates, and retroactive rebates. And I will conclude with a few practical observations. So let me go then to slide number 10, in which I'm going to describe the most important principles that underline the analysis of pricing abuses under ECE law, under Article 102. These are four principles. First, the goal of these price cost tests, the price cost test that I will describe in a few minutes, is to assess the possibility of anti-competitive effects. The idea is to try to understand whether a dominant company, through its pricing behavior, would be able to distort competition in the relevant markets, affecting the ability of their competitors to compete effectively against the dominant player. The second principle is the as efficient competitor test. The focus of the price cost tests employed by the Commission and the competition authorities in Europe is to understand whether an as efficient competitor to the dominant player would be able to compete effectively against the dominant player. The interest and the focus is not in determining whether any competitor, independent, irrespective of its degree of efficiency, would be able to remain in the market and exercise a competitive constraint. The focus is therefore on whether competitors that are as efficient as the dominant player, as the incumbent player, would be able to compete effectively, exercise a competitive constraint to the dominant player. The third principle relates to the type of costs that are included in these price cost tests. Traditionally, the analysis of the European competition authorities in pricing abuses focused on measures of cost such as the variable cost measure and the fixed cost measure. Variable costs are the costs of production and distribution that vary with the scale of production. Fixed costs are costs of production and distribution that do not vary with the scale of production. Traditional tests, therefore, were based on variable costs and fixed costs notions. But in the recent guidance of the European Commission on the application of Article 102, the focus shifts to different measures of costs: average avoidable costs and incremental costs, long-run average incremental costs. The average avoidable cost measure comes to replace the variable cost measure, and the long-run average incremental cost measure comes to replace the average total cost measure. When we talk about average avoidable costs, we're talking about the costs that can be avoided in case production and distribution is stopped, or the costs that can be avoided in case certain actions such as capacity increases don't take place, or capacity is reduced if production is stopped. Long-run average incremental cost refers to the cost that one needs to include or incur, whether they are variable or fixed, in order to conduct a certain activity. A new product is launched, certain variable costs would be incurred, some fixed costs would be incurred in that action. Those would be included in the calculation of the long-run average incremental cost. And the new price cost tests employed by the Commission following, the European Commission following its guidance document on Article 102, focus on those notions, average avoidable cost and average incremental cost, because they fit better the theories of harm that underline the Commission's guidance, and they and therefore allow for a much better and much more accurate analysis of the impact that certain pricing practices would have on competition. The last principle looks beyond the price cost tests. The analysis of pricing abuses under ECE law rests, and importantly, on the performance, on the application of price cost tests, but doesn't stop there. It's not enough to understand or to verify that the price cost test is not met. It is important to go beyond the price cost test and understand whether foreclosure would be possible in that market, because the market or the portion of the market that is covered by these, you know, extreme pricing practices would be sufficient to impede competitors or to deny the sufficient scale to competitors so that they would not be able to match or to be able to compete effectively with the dominant firm. Let me go now to slide number 11, where we start seeing this price-cost test in application. This slide deals with predatory pricing, and I have included two types of practices here, which, you know, to a large extent are very similar: predatory pricing and incremental rebates. In predatory pricing, what we have is a situation in which the dominant company charges a price for all of its units, both marginal units and inframarginal units, a price that is below a measure of cost. The test in Europe has two limbs. The first limb is the comparison of the price versus the average avoidable cost. If the price is below average avoidable cost, one concludes that this is an instance of predatory pricing. The reason being that a company that is maximizing short-term profits would not price below average avoidable cost. But there is a second limb of the test in Europe, and this applies to situations where the price is above average avoidable cost but below long-run average incremental cost, and there is, in addition, evidence of intent. A firm that is maximizing short-term profits may price above average avoidable cost, but is not going to continue for a long period of time doing so, because otherwise the initial investments would not be justified. In the absence of evidence of intent, you can assume that this departure from what would be optimal pricing from a long-run perspective may be due to conditions in the market that force prices, you know, to be set at low levels, conditions that you know, one would expect to be temporary. If there is evidence of intent, this indicates that this pricing, this relatively low pricing, follows an exclusionary strategy and may, you know, distort competition in the long term. Let me look at now incremental rebates. In the case of incremental rebates, prices are set, in the picture, at a level P1 until a certain level of demand, say X. And once you move beyond X, prices go down to a level P2. The incremental price, you know, for levels of quantity above X is P2. What you compare in this case is whether the level of prices P2 is above or below the same measures of cost that I referred to before in the case of predatory pricing. Here, the dominant company that is setting a low price P2 is trying to predate at the margin. It's not applying the same pricing conditions for inframarginal quantities below X and marginal quantities above X. It's just trying to predate at the margin. But if X is sufficiently low and the margin is the quantities at the margin were sufficiently important to justify entry, and that entry is no longer profitable because of price P2, then this strategy can have exclusionary consequences. And predation at the margin may be equally effective in terms of excluding competitors. And in fact, not only that, but it may be also more rational since it involves a lower sacrifice. Let me move then to slide number 12, where we talk about margin squeeze. Here we have a very different situation. We have a vertically integrated company with a position in the upstream market and in the downstream market that competes against a downstream competitor, say D2. The practice or the behavior that competition authorities are particularly interested in is the setting of the wholesale price W. And what competition authorities in Europe try to test and understand is whether the difference between the price that the dominant vertically integrated player charges in the downstream market, P1, and the price that it sets in the upstream market, W, would be sufficient to cover a measure of costs, in this case, the long-run average incremental cost. If it doesn't, if the price, the downstream price minus the upstream price, if P1 minus W is below the long-run average incremental cost, then D2, even if as efficient as the vertically integrated company in the downstream market, D2 would be excluded, would not be able to compete. And you can understand that this is another form of predatory behavior, because it's a way of denying a scale or denying the competitor D2 the ability to compete effectively in the downstream market. Why is long-run average incremental cost the measure that is used in this case? The justification for the use of this cost measure rather than average avoidable costs is because this practice, which involves some sacrifice of upstream profits for the vertically integrated company, doesn't need to lead to outright losses like predation, and can therefore be sustained for a long period of time. The competitor therefore may be denied profits for a long period of time and may see no justification therefore for its initial investments. Moving on to slide number 13, we have the situation of bundle rebates. What we have here is a very simple example in which we have a player that offers a sports package, a movie package. This is a pay TV operator, and also a bundled product that involves both sports and movies. The prices, respectively, for the unbundle and the bundle packages are £15, £15, and £20. Now, from this configuration, for these three different packages, we can infer what is the incremental price of the movie channel in the bundle. We can take the price for the sports and movie package, £20, subtract the price for the standalone sports channel, £15, and that gives us the incremental price of the movie channel, £5. Competition authorities in Europe, in order to understand whether this bundle rebate generates or is capable of generating foreclosure effects, in this case on movies, will look and compare the incremental price of £5 with the long-run average incremental cost of the movie channel. Once again, the measure of cost used here is long-run average incremental cost, and the idea here is because this pricing policy, this bundle rebates strategy, like the margin squeeze before, can be sustained for a period of time, a very long period of time, because it involves no losses. There may be some sacrifice, but that sacrifice doesn't lead to outright losses like predation would do, and therefore can be sustained for a long period of time and deter not only players that are in the market at the moment, but also new entrants. Hence, focus on long-run average incremental cost. If I move to slide 14, we have yet another form of predation at the margin. This time, the dominant player is using a rebate, but not an incremental rebate. It's using a retroactive rebate, a rebate to the first pound or the first dollar or the first euro. It charges a price P1 for a certain level of demand, but beyond that level of demand, C charges a price P2. Now, this price P2, once demand goes above the level of demand C, not only applies to additional units, to the units that go for the demand or quantity that goes from C to A, it applies retrospectively to the first dollar. And that means that once you reach the level of demand C, the discount that is effectively provided beyond C is not just the difference between P1 and P2. You also have to take into account the volume or revenue, the total revenue that is saved on the inframarginal units that is on the demand from 0 to Z, which you have in this square or rectangle that is shaded in black and white. That would be applied, that those savings would be applied to the contestable units, to the demand that goes from C to A, and that is what you have in the rectangle shaded in red, and means that effectively the price that is charged for those units that go beyond C and up to the level of actual purchases A is not P2, it's P3. Again, because you have to think not only of the initial discount on the marginal units, P1, P2, but the fact that for all those additional units, units above C, what we call the contestable segment, you have to apply the discount that comes from the fact that you're saving money from 0 to C for all those quantities. And at this point, you have calculated the so-called effective price, and you can compare, you can perform your price cost test, which would be the comparison of this effective price, again, to the long-run average incremental cost. What's the logic between the long-run average incremental cost? Like in margin squeeze, like in bundle rebates, this predatory strategy at the margin involves some sacrifice, but no outright losses, can be sustained for a significant period of time, not only may exclude existing players, may also deter new players that need to invest and therefore that would only do so if they are able to cover their long-run average incremental costs. This is a long-term strategy, or is a strategy or predatory strategy that can be sustained for a long period of time, hence focus on long-run average incremental cost. Let me conclude this quick presentation with a few practical considerations. When you read, standard textbooks on the economics of Article 102, in particular as applied to pricing abuses, you see that a tremendous amount of attention is devoted to the calculation of the marginal price, the incremental price, the effective price. And we have seen that this was indeed the case in some of the previous slides, in particular when dealing with bundle rebates and retroactive rebates. And this is, you know, perhaps one of the most exciting and interesting bits of the analysis of these pricing abuses, but it's not necessarily the most important part of that. It is absolutely important and central that time and care is spent in the calculation of the relevant cost measure, in the analysis of what are the costs that are avoidable if a certain practice is discontinued, a certain predatory practice is discontinued, or what are the true incremental costs associated with the launching of a product, the increase in capacity, the investments needed in order to develop, to continue operating in the market. It is important to understand what is the cost measure that needs to be applied, and that is going to depend on the theory of harm. Is this predation? Is this predation at the margin? Is this predation through rebates, retroactive rebates? It is important that once the theory of harm is clear and once we understand what kind of abuse is being chased or analyzed, that then we look at what is this, what are the sources of information, cost information that are available, typically, you know, from accounting sources, and how to match that accounting data to the theory of harm in order to develop and calculate meaningful or at least economically meaningful cost measures. It is important that the accounting data is adjusted so as to develop economically meaningful cost measures such as the average avoidable cost and the long-run average incremental cost. It is important for that that good cost accounting data is available, but that's not sufficient. That's necessary, but not sufficient. It's very important that one understands how those accounting figures have been calculated, what are the sources, the raw sources, the raw data that was used in order to produce financial statements, balance sheets, profit and loss accounts, that one understands, therefore, whether the costs were avoidable, were incremental, for which one needs to understand exactly how the business is conducted. And this explains my last point in this slide, in slide number 15, is that in order to be able to conduct this price-cost test effectively, you need not just economists, you need accountants, and not just accountants, but also economists, and you need to have both sets of skills in at your disposal, because otherwise you may end up with price-cost tests that are either factually incorrect or meaningless from the viewpoint of the competition policy analysis. And with that, I'll stop.
Thanks very much, Jorge. We're going to open for questions and comments on the first two presentations. I'm going to hand over to the administrator of the call, Chris, who's going to describe the process to be followed by people wishing to pose questions. And I understand that might take a minute or so. So after Chris has described that process and people can put themselves in the queue, I'll go first of all for comment to one of the other panelists, to Joe Anglin. So I'll ask Chris to describe, as a call administrator, how to put yourself in the queue for a question or a comment. And while people are doing that, and after Chris has finished speaking, I'll go first to for a comment to Joe Anglin. So first over to Chris and then Joe.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then zero on your phone keypad. You'll hear an acknowledgement tone, and then an operator will take your name and further instruct you. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if anyone has a question, please press star then zero at this time. Please
okay,
allow.
So while people are doing that process of getting themselves in the queue and talking to the relevant person on the other end of the line to do that. Joe, have you got comments or questions on the first two presentations?
Sure, a comment regarding each. First, at the outset, David mentioned the distinction between applying a price-cost test or just looking at a profit-sacrifice test. And for a variety of, I think, pretty good reasons, courts and agencies tend to focus upon cost-price tests. But having said that, and this will come up when I discuss the American Airlines case later on, I think it's worth considering whether in some contexts, particularly capacity expansion contexts, it doesn't make sense to look at profit sacrifice. If you look at the case law in the United States, you know, the cases seem to point to two reasons why you shouldn't apply any notion of profit sacrifice in any type of predatory pricing test. The first is what I think is the demonstrably wrong reason, that if you punish profit sacrifice, people will find it impossible to respond to reduced prices by competitors, and thus you'll be impeding pro-competitive price cuts. Well, the cases that say that seem to ignore the fact that price cutting can be profit maximizing, certainly when faced with lower prices. If you're not going to sell anything at your high price, there's nothing inherently sacrificing about lowering your prices to meet competition. But secondly, and more powerfully, you know, courts are understandably reluctant to demand perfection from businesses. It's hard enough for economists to get together and figure out what a profit-maximizing price or a profit-maximizing capacity expansion is. And to second-guess businesses based upon that would be very difficult and might well discourage pro-competitive activity. But having said that, as a general principle, if you just posit a hypothetical that the Department of Justice felt they had in reality in the American Airlines case, what if a company, you know, clearly says, look, what we're going to do is increase capacity, knowing that the price will be such and such, and that the result will be that we will sacrifice profits. However, we will, by doing this, drive the competitor out of business, and we will recoup those lost profits in the following way over the following years. Well, one wonders whether it should be an absolute rule that you couldn't apply profit sacrifice as a test in that sort of context. So I think what may make sense in one context here doesn't make sense necessarily in another. With respect to Jorge, and can you possibly pull up his slide 11, where he was talking about the incremental rebate there? And I think this is a good illustration of why courts and agencies need to think hard about what cost test they're applying. I think most United States courts would wind up applying an average variable cost test, looking at whether P2 was an acceptable price. However, what if the market situation is such that at that range of output, and I realize we're talking about one firm here, but if you magnify this over all the customers that would be buying from the firm, what if at this range of output, average incremental marginal cost is below average variable cost? In other words, you could have a situation where focusing clearly, entirely upon the incremental output that the company will be able to sell by dropping its price to P2 beyond a certain level, that incremental revenues will exceed the incremental costs if, for example, the companies are operating at far below full capacity. And in this case, the slavish reliance on average variable cost may distort the fact that it could be profit maximizing and pro-competitive to offer a lower price that was below the average variable cost but above the marginal cost. That's it.
Thanks, Joe. Let David and Jorge come in right now, but see if we can get some questions online, and if those are there, then we'll allow David and Jorge to come in with their responses. Chris, are there questions?
Yes, we have a question from the line of Alden Abbott. Please go ahead.
Yes, a question regarding slide 13. Jorge described bundled rebates on sports and movie channels. I mean, there's a real literature that suggests that this bundle may be directed at consumers who have different intensities of preference, different valuations of different products. And it may effectuate price discrimination, but it may also enhance consumer welfare vis-a-vis a situation in which the bundle wasn't allowed. And obviously that was not discussed. I mean, to what extent should those efficiencies be explored, even if, hypothetically, the incremental price was below longer than average incremental cost?
Thanks, Alden. Maybe we'll take one more question if there is one, and then go to David and Jorge. Is there another question, Chris?
There are no other questions.
Okay, great. Well, maybe we can start with Jorge to answer Alden's question and Joe's, and then go back to David to round up on this set of presentations. Jorge?
Great. I think that the answer relates to one comment I made in slide number 10. Actually, it was the last principle when I said that one needs to look beyond price-cost tests. The test that is described in 13, the price-cost test that is described in 13, would tell us that this pricing practice is capable of having foreclosure effects. Not only that it's capable, one would say that it's also likely to have foreclosure effects because a standalone competitor, a competitor that can only offer movies channels, would not be able to compete effectively against the dominant player that applies these dominant rebates because it would not be able to find, you know, prices that cover its long-run average incremental costs and that generate demand. Now, once we have done that, we need to see whether, this price-cost test in itself, gives rise to potential foreclosure effects. One would need to see, for example, whether there are competitors, the competitors that we are looking in practice are competitors that are able to bundle as well, and therefore that we would be in a situation in which there is bundle-to-bundle competition, which would be, you know, possibly pro-competitive. And beyond that, one would have then to consider whether there are efficiency justifications and objective justifications for this practice. Now, Alden, I think that was suggesting the possibility that through bundling, we are able to price discriminate and therefore, you know, be able to bring into the market new consumers that would not be able to if we were not pricing using some form of mixed bundling strategies, and that's I think a point in which is absolutely right, but one has to recognize that in this case it's not just price discrimination. There is also an element of cross subsidies, and that then one would have to trade off these potential benefits against the anti-competitive effects that this practice is likely to have. It would be possible perhaps to price discriminate, setting the price of the bundle at a higher level, and at that point, you know, one would be able to price discriminate, generate efficiencies without having the exclusionary effects. And this leads me to conclude by saying that when efficiencies are postulated, one has to see, you know, whether indeed the pricing behavior that we are trying to justify is indeed indispensable to achieve those efficiencies, or whether there would be alternative pricing strategies that would generate efficiencies of the same sort without being able to, or without causing the distortion of competition that that we are trying to avoid.
Thanks, Jorge. David?
Sure, yeah, it's a good question. And I agree that sometimes the rule should be based on profit sacrifice rather than below-cost pricing in particular cases. Let me give you one such example that I wrote about, a post-entry price cut. If a dominant firm cuts price substantially upon entry, this could deter entry in the first place. So you have a threat of behavior that deters entry on one hand, and you don't see it in equilibrium on the other hand. So it might be a good idea to define this too as illegal predatory behavior, even though it's above cost. I guess it turns to the debate about whether the correct criterion is consumer welfare or total welfare, because, you know, such rules that I am in favor of favor at times less efficient firms than the dominant firm. But from a consumer welfare point of view, this it may indeed be a good idea.
Thanks, David. Thanks. Just as a general point, I suppose it's important that while we're looking at the role of price-cost tests, we're certainly not doing that in they wouldn't be done in a vacuum. And, you know, we wouldn't be ruling out, for example, efficiency justification. So I think we're focusing on the role of price-cost tests in this seminar. But, of course, there would be other facts that would come into play. So I think it's very useful. Thanks to David and Jorge. And we'll move straight on to Martin now, Martin Mandorf from the Swedish Competition Authority, who's going to take us through the application of price cost test in one of their cases involving retroactive rebates. Martin?
Thanks, Simon. So I'm going to talk about an investigation we did in 2009 when we looked into a retroactive rebate schedule that was applied by the Swedish Post, in Swedish called Posten. And just like Jorge talked about, our analysis will also follow the principles of the EU Commission, so it's EU law that we're applying here. So we can move on to slide 18 here. So first, just some background on the case. Sweden is one of the world's most liberalized, has one of the most liberalized mail markets in the world. Already in the early 90s, the monopoly was abolished on letter mail. And ever since then, there has essentially been two companies, the incumbent Posten and one challenger being City Mail that has been fighting the Posten ever since. And these two companies have been involved in numerous antitrust cases throughout the years. And at one point, the Posten was even took over Bring, but now Bring City Mail is owned by the Norwegian Post. And the rebate scheme that we've been looking into was a retroactive rebate on pre-sorted bulk mail. And this is the market where Bring City Mail is also active on. And it's a very simple retroactive rebate. That's why it's good. It serves as a good illustration of the main principles. So basically, it was a universal rebate applied to all customers who, for each shipment volume, if a shipment exceeded 300,000 mail items, then a 0.2 Swedish krona rebate, or let's say 20 cent rebate, was applied on each item in the entire shipment. So in that sense, it's retroactive in the sense that once you cross the threshold, it applies to the volume also below the threshold. And so when this scheme was introduced, Bring City Mail filed a complaint to the Swedish Competition Authority, and we opened the case investigation. And the method of analysis we applied is the people analysis here at the Competition Authority is the sufficient competitor analysis that Jorge talked about before too. And we used it here as a screening method to sort out pro-competitive to anti-competitive rebates. And we've done that several times before in similar cases. So we can move on now to slide 19. So the basic analytical steps that we follow are first, by EU law, we have to establish dominance, that Posten is dominant at one of the affected markets. And I'm not going to go into that here, but clearly they are dominant on the bulk mail market. And then what I'm going to describe here is how we calculate the effective price generated by the rebate and the cost measures we looked into, and then shipment by shipment, essentially, whether there's a risk of foreclosure, whether the effective price lies below the relevant cost measure. And finally, once we've done that, we can't just mechanically come to a conclusion, but we must still develop a theory of harm and see in what way does this rebate scheme risk hurting competition and not just hurting the competitor. So we can move on to the next slide, 20. So the first step is to determine the effective prices is to look into the question of contestable demand. And in this case, it's unusually clear, one can say, because the two companies have different service areas, whereas the Post, they have a universal service obligation and serve 100% of the households in Sweden, whereas Bring City Mail are specialized on the metropolitan areas. The three main metropolitan areas, and therefore serve only 50% of households. So for a given shipment volume, we can look at where the recipients of the shipment are and the percentage of the recipients that are in metropolitan areas, that's the percentage that is the contestable demand for that shipment. So we can move on to the next slide, 21. So now I'll repeat a little bit here what Jorge said about how to calculate the prices, but I'll do it from a slightly different angle. So if we think of an incremental rebate and we look at the total price of the shipment on the vertical axis and the volume on the horizontal axis, the price will be the slope of this line. So essentially, if you have an incremental rebate of 20 cents, up to the threshold you'll pay, say, for example, 2 kroner per item, and once you pass the threshold, you pay 1.8 kroner then. So this is how that would look. Whereas if we move to the next slide, 22, we'll see the effect of a retroactive rebate, where when the retroactive rebate, once you pass the threshold of 300,000 items, so this is the Posten rebate scheme, once you pass the threshold, the 20 cent rebate is applied to every single item. And so you'll get this discrete jump in the total price, essentially as you move beyond the 300,000 volume threshold, the total price drops from 600,000 to 540,000. And that's where you have this leverage effect that I will talk about later, where there's the risk of very low effective prices. So we can move to the next slide, 23. So if we don't have to look at different shipments and what the contestable share is on different shipments. So for example, if we identify a shipment where the main part of the recipients are in rural areas, and only a small part, say 10%, are in metropolitan areas, then the contestable share is 10%, and all that the competitor has to do to gain this contestable share of the shipment is to offer the price of 1.8 to beat this discount. So there's no leverage effect because you're not crossing the threshold. But if we move to the next slide, 24, if we see like what's more of the average customer, which would have a 50% contestable share, there, if you choose to give the metropolitan deliveries to bring city mail, then in some cases you will pass the threshold, i.e. the customer is going to lose the retroactive rebate, they're going to lose the 20 cent rebate, and there will be a larger effect on the total price. So just like Hawker said, we'll allocate the retroactive rebate entirely to the contestable share. So in this case, if you have a 20 cent rebate and you allocate it to 50% of the demand, you get an effective 40 cent rebate. And that's what you see here. Moving on to the next slide, number 25, for some customers that have a demand that's closer to this threshold, we can also have even negative effective prices, which is that they essentially, the total price goes down once you pass the threshold, and it would be impossible for Bring City Mail to compete against this attractive discount because they would actually have to pay the customer to allocate demand to Bring City Mail. However, one would have to be a bit suspicious of this kind of price effect since there are a lot of mail optimizers working on this market, helping firms to construct their deliveries, and it's unlikely that some firm would end up just below the threshold and not just increase their volume a bit so they can lower their total price. We move on to the next slide, 26. So we can use this method of calculating the effective price, and we get an effective price for each contestable share. So depending on the percentage that's delivered in metropolitan areas, we will have different effective prices that Bring City Mail will have to meet in order to gain a customer. And here it also depends on how big the customer is, since for high enough volumes, you're not going to pass the threshold even if the customer gives the business to Bring City Mail. So both the shipment volume and the contestable share comes in when we determine the effective price. Okay, so we can move to the next slide, 27. So what we do then is we can show this in with both variables that matter, the contestable share and the shipment volume. And what we see is that there is this abyss in the middle, which is where the effective price drops dramatically. So the shipments that fall into these low contestable shares and relatively low shipment volumes, that's where it will be very difficult for the competitor to beat this retroactive discount, even if they have very low costs. So that's the kind of shipments we're looking to identify, whether they are commonly occurring. Go to the next slide, 28. So what we then did is the actual empirical analysis, where we request the shipments from Posta and also to some extent from the competitor Citymail, and we try to look at how does demand look in reality. Are there a lot of shipments that that seem to fall into this category, where shipments have certain contestable shares and shipment volumes? So here's an illustration of how the data could have looked. And basically, what you see on the first line is where half of the volume goes to metropolitan areas, so there the contestable share is 50%, and the effective discount then is double the actual discount, so it becomes 40 cents. Whereas on the second line, you have a shipment that never crossed the 300,000 threshold anyway, so it was never it could never have received the 20 cent discount in either case. So therefore, the effective price is the original undiscounted price. And so on, we'll go through and we'll determine the effective price for each shipment. And like the last line here, you can see there might be shipments where we actually get a negative effective price. We'll move on to next slide, 29. So just plotting these on this graph I showed before, we can determine what share of the market essentially that ends up in the regions with low effective prices. We can move directly to slide 30. Now the next step is to determine the relevant cost, and here we follow the Commission guidance. And since we're applying, we're using this as a screening method, so we are at an initial stage here, so then we are quite harsh, so we'll always choose high-cost measures in order to identify whether there at least is a possible problem. And when we were in contact with Posten, it turns out that, of course, it's not that easy to get the perfect cost measure, but we settled it at this stage with the average total cost, which is a higher cost measure than the economically relevant cost measures. And this is especially likely to be higher because Posten has built a distribution network for distributing a lot of other products, like, for example, priority mail and normal non-bulk mail. So the average total cost is likely to be higher than the relevant, for example, long-run average incremental cost. And then we also obtained the data on what cost savings they had from the pre-sorting, which was the reason for the rebate. And quite naturally, you wouldn't be surprised that there are cost savings since pre-sorting, which essentially means that the customers send the mail sorted according to a zip code, that clearly saves some effort on for the postal operator, since they don't need to send this mail through their sorting machines. So finally, we use this cost measure, their average total cost, and then we deducted the cost savings depending on different volumes, how big the cost savings were. We can move on to the next slide, 31. So then we, using the efficient price, we deducted this cost, and this allowed us to identify shipments for which there was no cost coverage, where essentially efficient price was below the this relevant cost. We can determine what percentage essentially of shipments that were not where the efficient price was below cost and where bring ship to mail could not compete, given that they are given that they were equally efficient where they bring ship to mail could not compete. So this tells us which from which shipment bring ship to mail is foreclosed, but it does not in itself tell us whether bring ship to mail is foreclosed from the entire market, which is the what we're really interested about. Move to the final slide here, 32. So from based on the results, we have to build a theory of harm. So we've now identified some shipments where from which the competitors are foreclosed. And then we have to figure out, could this have foreclosure effects on the entire market? So one thing we might want to look at is, even though there's no recoupment criteria in EU law, we still, of course, think about the economic rationale for what's for the behavior of the dominant firm, and we might be especially worried in these kind of rebate schemes if we see that the dominant firm can set up this rebate scheme without incurring any cost, not even an opportunity cost. And this would, for example, happen if all their customers were above the threshold, so that all their customers received this discount. In that case, they could jack up the entire rebate scheme in a way so that they would charge, for example, monopoly prices on even on those customers that received the discount. But in this case, in this actual case, when we looked, we saw that customers ended up everywhere in terms of whether they got the rebate or not. So at least at first look, there was no indication that they could implement this rebate scheme costlessly. And finally, we looked at whether a significant share of the relevant markets were covered by this rebate scheme and whether these strong leverage effects and the foreclosure effects represented a significant share of the relevant market, in which case we would be worried that Bring Ship to Mail could have to exit the market because of this, or that they would have to cut down on investments and so on, and lower the competitive pressure. But once we have identified the shipments, we could see that it wasn't the foreclosed shipments were not a significant share of the market, not at least enough significant to cause any concern about anti-competitive effects. So therefore, this case, we closed this case and did not pursue it further. So that's an example of how you can apply this method of analysis in practice. So thank you. I'm done.
Thanks very much, Martin. I think let's go straight on to Joe Englund, who's going to take us through the American Airlines case in particular and the approach that U.S. courts have adopted. And then we'll have comments from the panel on the Swedish and American cases, as well as opening up to questions again. So, Joe, over to you.
Okay. Can we go to the first slide? Okay. I'm going to very briefly just give an overview of the U.S. law and then focus a little more upon the American Airlines case in particular. In the United States, the basic rule was provided in 1993 in the Brook Group test, which is you need proof both that prices are set below some measure of relevant costs and that the predator has a good chance to recoup its lost profits. Now, the Brook Group court explicitly declined to rule on what measure of cost should be used. It said, we're not going to get into the debate on that issue that's been going on in the Court of Appeals, in part because we don't need to resolve that to resolve this particular case. Most U.S. courts use average variable cost, recognizing that marginal cost is really the ideal measure but accepting average variable cost as a manageable proxy for it. Having said that, some courts acknowledge the possibility that prices that are above average variable cost could be deemed predatory, and there were, most of the courts have just said that in passing, but in the Northwest Spirit Airlines versus Northwest Airlines case a few years ago, a court, the appellate court, reversed a lower court's dismissal of the case. The lower court had said the evidence is clear that price was above average variable cost. The appellate court said, well, that may be so, but it is possible that prices above average variable cost can be predatory, so this case has to go to trial to see if it was in this context. The case settled, so we never got a final answer, but at least one court put some teeth in the observation that prices above average variable cost in some contexts could be deemed predatory. There has not been a lot of success in predatory pricing cases since the Brook Group decision. The American Airlines case that I'll talk about in a moment is an example of one of those ultimately failures. A brief comment on bundled pricing, which can be very brief because Jorge really has already covered it. Basically, the majority rule in the United States, most courts would apply the sort of test he applied to his movie and sports channel example. I have a slide here which attempts to illustrate the same thing, but there's no reason to repeat it. I will mention that there is one appellate court decision still hanging out there in the United States, the LePage's decision, which found bundled pricing illegal with really, without applying any price-cost test. It was almost an intent test. Was this, did it make it too hard on competitors of the dominant firm? That has not met with much favor either in terms of the academic commentary or in terms of other courts. With that basic structure behind us, let's then move to the American Airlines case. In 2001, the Department of Justice challenged alleged predatory investment or predatory pricing, depending how you looked at it, by American Airlines on certain routes from its Dallas hub. It began as a dominant firm with about a 70% share. It began to lose a little bit of share as low-cost carriers entered. Now, American Airlines responded by adding additional capacity, both more planes and larger planes on some of these routes. Internal American Airlines documents, at least as interpreted by the Department of Justice, stated that the approach made sense only if new entrants withdrew. That is, they recognized that profits would be sacrificed, to use the phrase in terms of language we used a while ago, but that if not only those firms, the firms that it was competing with now, but other firms that were contemplating entry saw how unprofitable the routes would be for them, they would stay out, and therefore American Airlines would make more money in the long run. Now, the Department of Justice's theory here was that the incremental revenues that American Airlines realized by adding capacity did not cover the incremental costs of such expansion. Significantly, the Department of Justice did not argue that if you looked at both the original capacity and the new capacity combined and computed the average variable cost, that that average variable cost was greater than the average price charged. So the focus was entirely upon the incremental capacity rather than looking at all the capacity. Next slide, please. Okay. Well, the DOJ did not fare well. It lost in the district court and on appeal, but the courts took very different views, and I think the difference is conceptually significant. The district court concluded that the Department of Justice had to prove that its prices were below average variable cost, looking at all capacity, all routes at issue. And the Department of Justice agreed it could not satisfy that test. Its focus was upon the incremental capacity. And, you know, if one wanted to criticize the district court decision, you could say it sort of slavishly followed the rule of applying average variable cost rather than thinking about whether it made sense in this particular context, given the nature of the theoretical competitive harm that was being discussed. Now, on appeal, the American Airlines prevailed again. The Court of Appeals affirmed the summary judgment in favor of American Airlines. However, the appellate court's approach was really quite different from the district court approach. The appellate court, first of all, rejected the notion that average variable cost must always be applied. Rather, it went back to the fundamental notion that marginal cost is really the ideal measure, and while average variable cost will often be the best proxy for that, in other contexts, other cost measures could provide a better proxy. The Court of Appeals specifically did not reject the Department of Justice's theory that even if average variable costs might, even if price might exceed average variable costs for all capacity on the route, you still could have predation if the revenues attributable, the incremental revenues attributable to the additional capacity did not exceed the incremental costs attributable to that capacity. So we had really no conceptual disagreement by the Court of Appeals, and it was in some ways a more enlightened decision, I think, than the district court decision. Now, the problem, though, is from the point of view of the Department of Justice, was the facts. Basically, the Court of Appeals found that that the accounting data on which the Department of Justice relied did not establish that the incremental revenues with respect to the additional capacity did not exceed the incremental costs associated with that capacity. The Department of Justice had not sort of done a ground-up, blank slate cost analysis. Rather, what it did was it took the accounting data that American Airlines used in its management accounting system, not its financial accounting, but its management accounting system, the system it used to make decisions regarding how to allocate its resources. It took that data and with some slight modifications of it, is propounded four different tests to see whether the revenues, whether price covered costs, basically, or whether the revenues associated with the additional capacity exceeded the costs associated with that capacity. Now, two of the four tests were rejected by both the district court and the Court of Appeals on the ground that they basically included all fixed costs or almost all fixed costs. As I recall, those tests allocated about 98% of the total costs of American Airlines down to the route level, so it obviously included a great number of fixed costs. And in fairness, the Department of Justice really didn't seem to rely upon those tests too much. They seem to be there more to buttress the other approaches, which were intended to focus upon incremental costs. With respect to the two measures of costs that were based upon incremental costs, the Court of Appeals had different reasons for rejecting each of them. One, it rejected because while the measure was labeled a measure of variable costs in the American Airlines system, it found that some costs that were included in there actually didn't vary with the amount of output, the amount of capacity on the route. For example, it included ticket agents in this particular measure of costs, and that wouldn't necessarily vary with the number of planes that you had on a particular route. There were various other costs like that the Court of Appeals found made this not really a measure of incremental or marginal cost. This particular measure, at least as presented by the Department of Justice, also included certain costs of aircraft ownership, which the court noted was traditionally treated as a fixed cost and should be, it said, at least in the context where, as here, no new planes were being purchased. Rather, planes were just being reallocated from other routes to this route. So that measure of cost was rejected as including too many fixed costs. The final cost measure was rejected for a reason that we discussed a little bit earlier, which is that essentially it used a profit sacrifice approach. American Airlines, not surprisingly, had accounting systems that showed it whether it would gain or lose money by moving a plane from one route to another route. Using those systems, the Department of Justice pointed out that American Airlines, by its own calculations, lost money by increasing capacity on these particular routes. The reason it lost money was that, not that the necessarily, at least according to this particular accounting system, not necessarily because price wasn't above the marginal cost, but rather it was because those planes were making more money on some other route. So, for example, if a plane was making a $100,000 profit on the route it was originally using and then was shifted to this particular route and made $40,000, well, that would show up as a $60,000 decrease in American Airlines' overall profitability because of the switch in capacity. And the court said, no, you're not. You should be using a cost price test, and in fact, what you're doing is using a profit sacrifice test here. Analytically, in economic terms, I guess you could say that what this approach did was include as a cost the opportunity cost of not being deployed on the other route. So with that, basically, the Court of Appeals, unlike the District Court, did not reject the economics of the Department of Justice, but it did reject the accounting for the most part, finding that the measures of incremental costs that were used weren't quite accurate. And if I can very briefly go to the next slide, actually two slides ahead, since I'm skipping over the slide that duplicates, go to the next one because Jorge really covered that. I'll just mention here I have a hypothetical based on American Airlines. I assumed away all the accounting problems, and really it's designed to simply illustrate that even in a situation where your average variable cost is below the price, you can, using an avoidable cost approach, have a situation where the company is going to lose money, the predator, the dominant firm will lose money through the incremental investment. And it raises the question, you know, why shouldn't this be an object of antitrust scrutiny? And it also, we just don't have the time for me to go through it in more detail, but it illustrates why one approach would be to take a look at, if you will, the second plane, the new plane being allocated to the route. You could judge whether it was covering its costs using the plane rather than the passengers, the incremental or marginal, you know, unit here, and whether the results should be different if passengers switch back and forth between the two planes, maybe because one's at a more convenient time, so that, yes, maybe each plane covers its cost, but some of the people who were on the second plane really would have been on the first plane if you hadn't added the second plane. And therefore, if you're looking at incremental revenues, they're not incremental revenues. And if you just look at incremental revenues and compare it to incremental costs, you wind up having a losing situation. And why shouldn't that be the object of antitrust inquiry? That's a little bit quick, but hopefully Exhibit B will give folks at least something to reflect on. That's it.
Thanks very much, Joe. That's great. I think that both presentations well illustrate the need to marry the facts with the theory in the specific cases. Want to open the lines. We've got a little bit of time left, a very little bit of time. So if Chris can open the lines again, maybe just quickly repeat what people have to do, and then we'll get any comments from David and Jorge while people are logging in.
And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, for questions, press star then zero on your phone keypad.
David, Jorge, have you got any kind of reflections or comments on the Swedish and American cases that were put up?
Two brief comments or questions for Martin and one for Joe. For Martin, one observation would be that retroactive rebates are similar to timed arrangements. You know, once you acknowledge the fact that you need a captive segment of the market and a contestable segment, then the captive segment could be analogous to the tying product, whereas the contestable segment is similar to the tied product. Another comment would be, if I understand correctly from the case that you described, then the discount wasn't tailored to the sizes of particular buyers. And in that sense, what's the difference between it and an ordinary quantity discount? Perhaps that may be one of the reasons why the case was dismissed eventually, because it's only by chance that a customer would be pressured by the scheme to and not buy from the rival, whereas the other buyers, because of their differing sizes, would be pressured less. So, you know, for the same reasons that quantity discounts are distinguished from retroactive rebates, perhaps that's the reason that this rebate scheme was also dismissed as predatory. And for Joe, I wanted to ask, what do you think about predatory investment in quality rather than capacity? You know, one can think about a dominant firm investing in quality in a way in which the incremental investment isn't covered by the incremental revenue. It might seem a very similar case. I guess with planes, when you see planes half empty, then the trigger for intervention becomes easier to apply, whereas when you see a dominant firm react to entry by investing in improvement of quality, then you might be more hesitant in even opening an investigation.
Thanks, David. I don't know, Jorge, if you have any very, very short comments before we get questions from participants.
Yeah, two quick comments. On Martin's presentation, I think that that illustrates very well how complicated it is to implement a retroactive rebate analysis. He has discussed almost every single component in great detail. I think that the only comment that I would have is that I think that in many cases, possibly not in this one, but in many cases, an element that is also quite complicated is the analysis of the contestable and non-contestable share. And in particular, what is the first question that I think that one has to ask oneself when running a retroactive rebate case is whether indeed there is any portion of demand that is non-contestable, and what is the reason why that portion of demand would not be contestable? Is it because of high switching costs that have to do with transaction cost or learning cost of using new products? Is it because of branding? Is it because of capacity constraints? And I think that that question is relevant when looking at the very short term. Is there any portion of demand that would be not contestable in the short term? But also, more importantly, and perhaps more difficult, in the medium and long term. Would an entrant perhaps be unable to compete for a portion of demand in the short term, but build a beachhead in the market, and eventually, therefore, what is non-contestable today would be contestable in the future once that entrant has built that beachhead? And I think that that's pretty important because and should go prior to any other calculation of efficient price, of effective prices, or of costs, because if there is no non-contestable portion of demand, then the theories of harm that are related to retroactive rebates lose all sense. The comment that I have for Joe's presentation is that I think that the American Airlines case illustrates very well the importance of having a well-specified theory of harm before running any or conducting any detailed economic investigation, and in particular before running any price-cost test. When the theory of harm is, for example, one in which a dominant player is cutting prices, just cutting prices but not increasing capacity in the system, working with average variable costs may make sense. When the theory of harm is that the dominant player is not just lowering prices, but is bringing new capacity into the market in order to be able to, really steal market share from competitors, then, average variable costs, make no sense, as Joe has clearly illustrated, and then you need to look for a different cost measure. And I think that this clearly illustrates that the cost measure that is applied has to be a sync with the theory of harm that is being developed. And a last comment, I think that the appeals court was absolutely right in not considering opportunity costs as part of the calculation of the relevant cost measure, because again, the problem that the competition competition agencies or the competition authorities should seek to deal with is not one of ensuring that companies actually allocate resources to maximize profits. You would expect that that's something that shareholders would do or other mechanisms of corporate governance would do. The issue is to ensure that an as efficient competitor is able to compete with a dominant player. And this as efficient competitor perhaps would not have alternative routes where it could deploy that capacity and obtain additional revenue. So those opportunity costs, I would submit, would not be part of the calculation of the as efficient competitor test. And in this respect, I think that this case also provides a useful illustration of what you're trying to achieve with price cost tests.
Thanks, Jorge. Chris, are there any questions on the line?
Yes, we have one question from the line of Chuck Webb. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. Hey, Simon. Just a question for Martin from Sweden. I understand that despite the Swedish competition authorities' closure of the case actually had more success in the courts in Sweden. And actually, according to MLEX, the Stockholm the commercial court found an abuse of dominance and actually declined to apply the EC's guidance in the case. I was wondering if you could you just kind of briefly describe actually what happened to the courts.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. Let's go to Martin and on that question and on the other questions, and then finish off with Joe.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
I'll start with Chuck's very interesting comment. And yeah, you're definitely right that just a few weeks ago, actually, the Market Court, which is the court of final instance in Sweden for competition law, in the private litigation, they found that this rebate scheme was an abuse of dominance. So it's a very interesting verdict, and it's you can take some analysis to look into how they're reasoning. But my personal view on what they're doing is that in Sweden there is no discovery in private litigation. So what's interesting is that in private litigation, the complainant, which is Bring City Mail, they have no way to perform the as efficient competitor analysis, since they don't have access to Posten's customer and cost data the way that the Swedish Competition Authority has. So for a complainant in private litigation, there simply is no way to perform a as efficient competitor analysis. So in order to establish foreclosure, it simply doesn't work to have that as a requirement in private litigation. And on the other hand, when Posten tried to defend itself in the process, if they would use their customer and cost data, they would have to in court, they would have to reveal it to their competitors. So they are in a kind of catch-22 where they have to choose between being found abusing of dominant position or revealing all their data to their competitor. So that's my private take on what happened is basically due to Swedish discovery rules and access to file in private litigation, whereas when the Swedish Competition Authority brings suit, we will have access to all the relevant data, and it doesn't need to be disclosed to third parties, which in this case would be Bring City Mail, would be a third party, and they would not get access to Posten's data. So there's an interesting discrepancy in Sweden between what happens when there's private litigation versus when the Competition Authority brings suit. And then finally, to answer David's questions, yes, it definitely can be viewed as a tying arrangement between, you would have, think of it as a rural product, which is where Posten has a monopoly, and the urban product where there's competition and there's tying between these two. The only difference from any kind of tying, from standard tying arrangement, is that there are common costs here since there are economies of scale at the national level when you distribute mail. And then when it's regarding to quantity discounts, it's definitely the case that there's no conceptual difference between an incremental price rebate or an incremental rebate and a... Sorry, am I running out of time?
We are running out of time, yeah, I think. But so if we're going to give Joe 30 seconds, I think we should move perhaps on to him. Joe, 30 seconds only, I'm afraid.
On predatory investment in quality has got magnifies the problems of predatory investment in capacity. False positives, of course, are very scary. You don't want to discourage increase in quality. And it's very tricky to figure out the incremental revenues. If you increase quality on a plane flight by giving away sandwiches for free as opposed to charging them, figuring out what portion of people will actually fly your airline because of that, very daunting, and therefore a large risk of false positives. So I think courts are going to be more reluctant in that context than in the pure pricing capacity context to apply one of these tests or to find liability.
Okay, well, thanks everybody. Apologies for cutting Martin off, particularly not allowing for more time for questions. I'm not sure what happens at the end of the 1.5 hours, whether everybody's going to get suddenly cut off. So, but we have run out of time, I think I hope it's shown how important it is to marry the theory and the theory of harm with the appropriate data, and that people on the call are going to be able to use the insights from the call to make these issues more tractable, though not necessarily easier to deal with. And I think I'd want to urge everybody to stay in touch with these issues as the Unilateral Conduct Working Group deals with it and works on the workbook, which will incorporate the key insights from this discussion. So thanks again to all the presenters, and I hope it's been useful to all the people who dialed in. Thanks again.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes your conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Executive Teleconference Service. You may now disconnect.